Nearly all Americans receive vaccines. The federal government Centers for Disease Control and Prevention currently recommends 70 doses of 16 different vaccines between birth and the age of 18. And all 50 states mandate between 30 and 45 doses of vaccines for admission to daycare and school. Public health officials state that the vaccines are safe and effective, but the truth could be far more complicated. In a moment, we will talk about vaccine epidemic right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to have a number of guests throughout the night, but staying with us for the entire evening is Mary Holland, research scholar at NYU School of Law. She graduated from Harvard College, holds graduate degrees from Columbia University, and is the co-founder and board member of the Center for Personal Rights. She, along with Louise Habakus, edited the book Vaccine Epidemic, which is a compilation of stories by experts on vaccines. Here is Mary Holland. Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, George.
My pleasure. Tell me a little bit about the organization, Center for Personal Rights.
Center for Personal Rights is a new, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that advocates the right to personal choice in vaccination.
And how did it start? Why did it start?
It started from the sense that there really was not a civil liberties organization or any other organization that was adequately defending and advocating for the right to personal choice in the area of vaccination.
All right. We're going to, later on tonight, Mary, we'll be talking with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He's been on the program with me before. He was on about a year ago. Very controversial person. We'll get into that a little bit later on. But he's the one who said, look, the multi-vaccines aren't good. They cause autism. But he got his hand slapped, basically, by organizations, a medical journal, and a reporter. And we're going to talk with that reporter later on, too, because I want to find out why he has gone after Andrew Wakefield. But I also want to get your thoughts on this entire case. How, when you put this compilation together, the vaccine epidemic, how important was Andrew Wakefield's thoughts and theories?
Mm-hmm. George, we include a chapter by Dr. Wakefield, and I authored a chapter in the book about Dr. Wakefield and the case through the fall of 2010 against him. And I think he's an important figure, but I really don't want us to lose sight of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, are vaccines safe? Should they be compelled? Are they as effective as they say they are? Is there a link between vaccines and the epidemic of autism in the developed world? Those are the real questions. The whole Brian Deere, Andy Wakefield story since 2004 about the Lancet journal piece from 1998, it's relevant. It is not the main story.
I agree with you. I mean, we need to set the record straight for Andrew Wakefield. And, you know, to find out why he's been attacked and why the reporter is going after him and in his journalistic way to do that. But you're absolutely right. The issue is vaccines in general. But the problem is if Andy is wrong, it taints part of his approach, which then could affect everything. I, for example, Mary, I don't take the flu shot. I've never taken the flu shot. I do not advocate people to take it or not to take it, but I don't. And you know what? Knock on wood, I've never had the flu. I've got questions about vaccines for children. If I were to do it all over again with my three kids, I don't think I would have them, you know, pelted with these vaccines the way we did when they were little. I've got my own thoughts. I think it's an individual decision. But I would like us to give as much information to people listening today, because I don't want to start them panicking, nor do I want them to feel as if, you know, they're right, they're wrong.
George, I agree with you 100%. My view and the view in the book is really only individuals can make this cost-benefit analysis. Everybody has a different biology. The government or medical organizations can recommend all they want, but at the end of the day, because every vaccination carries real risks Nobody's going to disagree with that. It has to be the individual with the healthcare practitioner that makes that informed choice. That's the standard of ethical medicine. It is free and informed consent. And we believe it applies here just as for any other medical intervention.
Well, we know one thing, Mary. We know that Big Pharma needs market share. They need new diseases. They need vaccines in order to try to cure these diseases. I'll put the word cure in quotes. I'll cite the H1N1 virus. There is no way they could have come up with a vaccine that fast the way they did, and they sold hundreds of millions of doses. How do they do this?
Well, I think that they were able to work very quickly, George. I think there was a lot of pressure from governments and from the World Health Organization and within industry to fast-track that intervention. As it turned out, it was not the flu epidemic that they expected it to be by a long shot. And there were serious questions raised throughout the world about how that all unfolded and why.
I think it was a scam.
You're right. Yeah. Well, many people think that. I think you're absolutely right that that pharma is facing some important challenges. And one of the chapters in our book by a businessman by profession, Michael Belkin, really focuses on that, that the pharmaceutical industry is facing what he calls patent cliffs. Some of their big blockbuster drugs are going off patent. They're looking at lower profits. And one of the places they're looking for escalation of profits is in vaccines.
You know, when the World Health Organization said at 350 worldwide cases, not deaths at the time, but cases, that we were on the verge of a pandemic, I said, you know, there's something weird here. There's something going on. It's very strange. And then when some of these cases started, and again, it was minuscule, then the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention started talking about how it was going to be severe in the United States. You know, they talked about the few hundred deaths that might have occurred. Nobody said anything about the 36,000 seasonal deaths that occur from the so-called regular flu. And they don't call that a pandemic. To me, it's worse. I don't understand.
I think you make good points.
So let's get into this vaccine epidemic, and let's talk about this corporate greed and biased science. What's going, in your opinion, what's going on?
Well, in my opinion, George, there's a framework around vaccines that is unique in this country, and that is that Congress passed a law in 1986 called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, which was meant to do three things. It was meant to give limited liability to vaccine manufacturers in order to keep the supply of vaccines stable for children around the country. It was meant to make vaccines safer by putting money into greater research, and it was meant to provide money for compensation for children injured by vaccines, because there was an acknowledgement that vaccines in a mandatory universal program would injure some people. The problem is the only component that has really worked unquestionably is the component of limited liability for manufacturers. So there have been huge incentives over the last 30 years to increase the number of vaccines and to increase the number of doses. It's basically, there's just not a lot of liability associated with it. And so that is a central component. The coercion is that states can mandate these. So these are not products that people have the full right to choose to accept or not, because they're mandated. Kids can't go to daycare or school. And because the scientific world is so closely associated with the pharmaceutical industry at this point, again, that was through some federal laws, we think that a lot of the science around vaccines has been biased.
Even Andrew Wakefield would admit that some vaccines work. He's not opposed to all of them. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, Dr. Wakefield is, first of all, you know, the idea that there is a movement out there that is anti-vaccine, I find a kind of a laughable idea. There are two books that sort of make that case that are on the market right now. I don't know anybody. I mean, I know very, very few people who would really say that they oppose all vaccines in all forms at all times. It's like every other question. It's a question of context. And, you know, in some contexts where there's an epidemic disease and the only known way to combat it is a vaccine, that may be a great choice. As you said in your case, For you, flu hasn't been an issue. There are issues about the safety of the flu vaccine and its efficacy. You elect not to use it. We think all vaccines really should be subject to that individual cost-benefit analysis.
Absolutely. I mean, I take a lot of natural supplements. I've done a lot of research to try to boost my own immune system. Maybe I've been lucky, Mary, but, you know, I don't take the flu vaccine. I don't, tell my kids that they should take it. They, you know, I'm trying to let them make up their own minds as well. They're all adults. And that's just the way I've been.
Georgia, like it in our book, one of the great chapters is by a lawyer named Jim Turner. And he worked with one of the very early scientists in the U.S. vaccine program, a doctor by the name of Dr. Tony Morris. And he's now in his early 90s. And Jim asked him, he said, Tony, what would you like to tell the American people for this book, Vaccine Epidemic? And he said, tell them I don't take the flu shot.
Millions of people are vaccinated. They seem to do okay. Are you more opposed to the mandatory vaccines or other vaccines in general?
I'm not opposed to vaccines, George. I am opposed to not letting people make rational, informed decisions, okay, healthcare decisions for themselves. I'm not opposed to any vaccines. I think that manufacturers, of course, should have the opportunity to innovate and to come up with new products. I have no objection to that. What I have a big objection to is forcing those products on children or on people, and if they don't except that, they can't work or they can't go to school. That is coercion, that is duress, and that is what we do in every state in this country.
In St. Louis County, where I spend a lot of time, there were a couple cases of hepatitis in a restaurant. And so they basically have mandated now all restaurant employees, all of them, need to get the series of hepatitis shots. Should they do that? Should they mandate workers who are working in the public's eye all the time to have to get a vaccine? Or should they say, sorry, because, I'm not sure, does that hepatitis vaccine even work?
Well, I think that these are very important questions. And the purpose of our book is to spark a more informed, more rational, calmer debate on these questions. I think you raise an important point. In New York State, for example, the New York State authorities tried to impose last fall the H1N1 vaccine on all healthcare workers, as well as an annual flu shot. That was taken to the courts, and the Department of Health lost, and they sort of backed down, frankly, after a temporary restraining order was put in place. But I think, as you raise, there are real efficacy questions, and there are real ethics questions. There's no question that these vaccines, hepatitis B, flu vaccine, can cause permanent injuries to people. They can cause death. That's really not a question. In our book, we include a personal narrative by a woman. She was in her 40s. She went to a local pharmacy to get a flu shot. She wanted to help protect her father, who was going to be undergoing surgery. She became paralyzed from her flu shot. And in her case, she actually got compensation from the federal government. The government acknowledged that it was her flu shot that caused her paralysis. So there, just none of these products are risk-free. And I just think we can't really compel people to undergo those risks without giving them the opportunity of free and informed consent.
Are the percentages high compared to, let's say, medicine pills that people would take? There's always risk with anything. Are they higher with vaccines?
I can't give you a good answer to that, George. I think what's different is that we don't compel aspirin. We don't compel penicillin. We don't compel any prescription drug which carries severe risk. I don't think vaccines are different than that. Vaccines carry risk. No informed person is going to tell you different from that. And yet, our public policies imagine that the benefits so enormously outweigh the risks that it is okay to compel this on infants and children. And we think that's really questionable. We also include in the book a short story by Ursula Le Guin. She gave us permission to include it. And it's a short story, the premise of which is there's a utopian society, but the utopian society has to pay a price for its utopia. And the question is, what price are we willing to pay? Are we willing to literally, have innocent babies die so that we can have an infectious disease-free society? Is that a price that we're all willing to pay? And are we imposing that price equally? People's biological constitutions are different. There's no question that some people are going to be more predisposed to vaccine injury than others. Is it fair to impose that cost on those people? Those are the questions we're trying to ask in this book.
Mary, we live in a very litigious society. I mean, you can't turn around without somebody getting sued for something. Are big pharmaceutical companies protected from lawsuits? What's going on here?
They are, George. That's the point that I raised with this 1986 law, and that's really a big part of the reason we have this problem around vaccines. Vaccine manufacturers were given very extensive liability protection for vaccines. That's not true for their other pharmaceutical products. And as you know, pharmaceutical manufacturers have been defendants in all kinds of lawsuits, and they have actually also paid out sanctions for having marketed things illegally. That is not uncommon in the pharmaceutical industry. But with respect to vaccines, an individual who thinks that a vaccine was defective or that it caused an injury, that person cannot just walk into state or federal court and bring a lawsuit. That is barred. You have to go to this specialized tribunal established under this 1986 federal law that's called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And you have to file there first. You have to file there within 3 years. And in that, it's just, in my view, it's a very, it is not an even playing field. So an individual claimant who's been injured has to bring a claim, and the government, Health and Human Services, represented by the Department of Justice, defends against that claim. And then the money, if there is money, would be paid out of a compensation fund that's funded by you and me whenever you buy a vaccine. There's a 75-cent tax on that. So it's a system in which there's some limited rights to then, after you filed in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, to file in a state or federal court. But that right is being reviewed right now by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Brusewitz versus Wyeth, and that's probably going to be decided in the next couple months. And even the right after you've filed in the VICP to go to a state or federal court for a vaccine design defect, even that right may be foreclosed by a Supreme Court decision. So there are a lot of institutional barriers to having real corporate accountability in this area. And that's why we talk about kind of greed without some of the same checks and balances that we have in almost every other area of a consumer economy.
Are there any whistleblowers within big pharma, people who would say, you know what, we did this study and this is what happened and here are the documents? Does that happen?
It does happen. It does happen. And my best guess, George, is that there are more whistleblowers who have not come forward. But there are whistleblowers in this industry. And I think that, you know, over the next few years, it's quite possible that we'll be hearing more.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. Tell me about doctors and scientists. I think they're all, you know, most of them are well-intentioned people. They want to help people. They want to help society. Why aren't they jumping up and down in droves? There are a few saying vaccines aren't good for you.
I think it's a very important question. We include several doctors and people with medical backgrounds in our books. As you said, it is a compilation, so we have lots of different perspectives. There are doctors and scientists out there who are critical of vaccine safety, but most of them really feel like they can't afford to do that, in part because of the scandal around Dr. Wakefield. They know that if they stand up and they say, gee, I think there's a problem, or gee, I think there needs to be more research, as Dr. Wakefield has, they will be potentially called on the carpet, and people will say, you are trying to kill babies. You are trying to drive down vaccination rates. I mean, that is what is being said about the people who are critical of vaccine safety. I mean, that's, in my view, that's ridiculous, and it's irresponsible public discourse to say that somebody who's trying to protect the public by having greater safety is actually trying to undermine safety. But that is the public, that is out there in the public.
More to come with you, Mary, in just a moment as we talk about vaccine epidemic right here on Coast to Coast AM. And a little bit later on, you'll get your opportunity to call in and tell us about your horrendous vaccine story or why you like vaccines and why they've been helpful to you. I'll be back in a moment, though, with Mary Holland as we talk about vaccine epidemic right here on Coast to Coast AM. Mary, why are they mandating that kids get vaccines and not adults?
Well, I think there's the view that children are more in closer contact with one another, and therefore they present a greater risk to one another. And there's, that's certainly true, and the vaccines are meant to prevent childhood diseases. I think one can ask questions about, is that really in the long-term strategy? And we have a doctor who writes in the book from that perspective, and another scientist who writes from that perspective of asking the question, is this really the best long-term trade-off? But it raises questions, George. Vaccine-induced immunity is temporary immunity. It does not last forever. It's not like getting the measles or getting the mumps, and then you have natural lifelong immunity. And so one of the questions we raise in the book is, if the theory of herd immunity is really true, which is what all vaccine mandates rest on, then really one would think that you would have to be continuing to vaccinate the adult population. And that's really not done, except for particular categories like healthcare workers. And so we just ask questions about this, of how accurate is the theory of herd immunity when it's based on vaccine-induced immunity instead of natural immunity.
In your book, in one of the pages of pictures, Appendix D, you talk about the Colorado Immunization Manual, and it shows how you can give up to 7 doses, 11 vaccines, 7 injections to one infant at one time. Are they crazy?
Yeah, it's done every day, George. It is. It's a very shocking picture. One of the things that we're very proud of in the book is we have a photo insert of pages, and we do give visual information that is relevant to the whole book. And this picture that you're talking about are pictures of 2 infants, and as you say, they're showing how you can give 7 injections, but it's actually many more doses of vaccines, or 7 doses of vaccines at once. And it's done a lot. And you know, in nature, you wouldn't generally be exposed with 7 different diseases all at the same time. But that's what we're doing artificially with vaccination. And there are injuries. I mean, there are injuries from vaccines. And I think one anecdotally, I don't think there's a lot of science on this, which is part of the problem with our system. But anecdotally, certainly you can look at cases compensated by this vaccine injury compensation program, and you see that more of the cases are multiple vaccines than they are single vaccines. But kids are mostly getting multiple vaccines at once now. Also, if you look, there's a vaccine adverse event report, and you see that it's very common that when people get 7 vaccines at once, or 9 doses, or 11, and that happens, that there are often injuries. It happens.
Is there any organized group of medical professionals who question the way that vaccines are being administered?
Yes. There are some medical groups that are speaking out about the way that vaccines are being administered. And one of the doctors in our book, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who I believe has been one of your guests, she is a part of doctors' group that out about vaccines and speaks about vaccine safety. That is specifically, it's not a students group, it's not a parents group, it is a doctors group. And we think it is. There are doctors who are speaking out in this debate. But as we said before, there are real costs to be paid by mainstream doctors here. And there are legal costs too, right? If a doctor is liable for malpractice and the standard of care in their area is considered to be recommending vaccines and giving vaccines to kids in their practice, they have real liability issues if they are not following that, if they're not making those recommendations. So this is a complicated area. We're not trying to suggest that there are simple, easy solutions here. It's complicated.
Is there a conspiracy here between government, big pharma, the medical world? I mean, we know, for example, when pills are administered, right? A salesperson will go to a doctor. Doctor might not really know what the pill really does. You know, they've been told by the marketing rep from the pharmaceutical company, and they'll recommend it. In the old days, Big Pharma used to take the doctors on trips and things like that. Is there a conspiracy here with the vaccines?
George, conspiracy isn't a word that I would use because it suggests that there is a clear, explicit agreement that everybody knows and is a part of. I don't think we have evidence of that. But what we certainly do have evidence of is common interest, a confluence of interest, that there are overlapping and aligned interests. And as we said, there's limited liability protection for industry. The government is promoting vaccines. They believe that this is answer to public health. And scientists are very closely, they get a lot of funding from the pharmaceutical industry. So all of these players in this system, including the doctors, they all make more money. They all get more professional kudos. They all do better if there are more vaccines. And they're not really stepping back and doing the science to say, is this level of vaccination safe and effective? They say that they're doing that, but they're not doing the gold standard study, which even the Institute of Medicine and the former director of the CDC agree would be the gold standard study. And that would be you compare children who have no vaccines to children who have vaccines over a period of a few years, and you look at their overall health outcomes after a few years of vaccinated versus unvaccinated. There's been bills in Congress to do that. The scientific establishment within the government and outside the government have not taken up that gauntlet. They are not doing that study. And people like Dr. Paul Offit, who speaks really for the industry point of view, they say it would be unethical to do that. They say that you couldn't leave children unvaccinated. That would be terrible because we know that that would put them at risk of disease. Well, you can take the flip side of that argument, which one of the chapters does in the book, and say, how can you impose these vaccines on children if you've never done the baseline study? So from our perspective, that science must be done, and there's an urgent need for more scientific investigation of vaccine safety.
How many vaccines for kids are they putting into one vaccine? How many doses are they putting into one vaccine?
We have an appendix that's called Counting Vaccines. There are vaccines on the market that in one injection has five different antigens. There are some that even more than that, that are seven, there are 11, in PCV 11. There are some that are 11 different strains of antigens. But remember, because it is now typical that kids are getting multiple vaccines at once, and some of those vaccines are themselves multi-dose vaccines, it is typical that children are getting exposed to many different vaccines against many different diseases at once. I'm looking at the federally recommended schedule that we include in the book. So, for instance, at the two-month visit for a baby, right, for 2 months,
right,
that baby is being recommended to get five different vaccines, but one of those, for instance, is the DTP, the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. So that's actually three different antigens. So the kids are getting vaccinated with, they're just getting levels of vaccines that, I don't know how old you are, George, but
906.
You go. When you were 906, you know, they might have given you one vaccine at a time, and they probably gave it to you later. What we have now are many more vaccines, many much earlier in life.
I think, though,
that we really haven't done all the studies that should be done.
I think they popped me, though, with a monkey virus and stuff. You know, I'm a kid from the 50s, so I had all that junk put in me that they didn't understand.
Well, you know, there's a lot of experience in all of these vaccines, George. And, you know, there is evidence that there's DNA from different animals that they didn't know was in there. We didn't get to put in our photo insert sort of a list of excipients that is on federal databases. But, you know, mercury, formaldehyde, aluminum, these are all things that are in vaccines in small amounts, but they're in vaccines. So these are very potent. These are potent medical interventions.
How effective is the tetanus vaccine, you know, to prevent lockjaw or something like that?
You know, George, I'm not a scientist. I think that it is probably, I don't know the data on it. I don't know that it's not effective. I know that it's temporary immunity. I know that it's recommended that you get it every 10 years or so.
Right.
I also certainly am familiar with cases of vaccine injury from the tetanus vaccine and severe injury. You know, one of the things that's really problematic is that when people are injured by vaccines, it's not like, you know, they get a stomach virus, right? And they're in bed for a couple of days. A severe injury from a tetanus vaccine is somebody is permanently brain injured. That happens. Then somebody can't walk for the rest of their life. People, you know, those are the kinds of, you know, mental retardation. Those are the kinds of injuries that we're talking about for vaccine injuries. So they're not trivial injuries. It's not like even breaking your arm and 3 months later, everything's back to normal. And in the narratives that we have of vaccine injury, I mean, these are really profound injuries. One of the cases that we have is the story by a mom of her daughter who got the human papillomavirus vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine. A girl was about 14. And, you know, the mom was trying to just be a good mom and a good parent, and she did what her doctor said. And, you know, she had no expectation that there'd be, you know, she just was getting the vaccine for her kid like she thought she was supposed to do. And the girl became paraplegic. The girl's lost all speech. The girl lives in a bed in the family living room.
Because of that vaccine.
That's the only explanation that makes sense. But one of the important things, George, is that all of the doctors deny that. We live in a culture that says so strongly vaccines are safe and effective. They're safe and effective. That literally all the doctors, when this girl is starting to have seizures, she's taken to the emergency room, she can't speak, you know, she can't move her limbs. The doctors are saying, you know, you're faking it. You know, we're going to put in video cameras to prove that you're fabricating this.
Oh, my God.
And if you read the narratives in our book, that is a common theme, that the doctors can't believe that these symptoms are actually there. They definitely can't believe that it could possibly be related to the vaccine. And they're accusing these people of fabricating their illnesses. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, why don't they administer these vaccines to kids in single doses instead of hitting them with like DPT-3 at one time?
Well, I think the reason, George, is because the schedule for vaccines is so crowded. The federal government in the United States is recommending 70 doses of 16 vaccines by the time a kid is 18
and
years
old. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but to do that singly would mean, you know, 70 different visits. I mean, that would be a lot of visits. So there's this idea of, oh, well, it doesn't matter. Let's just bundle them. Let's bundle the vaccines. And that was really at the heart of the controversy with Dr. Wakefield, which you can ask him about, is he said, you know, I don't think the safety studies have been done to bundle measles, mumps, and rubella together. I think the safety data is much clearer for single-dose vaccines. And that's what he recommended back in 1998 based on his study that was published in The Lancet. And the government in the United Kingdom thought that somehow threatened their MMR program and that the government withdrew the single-dose measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines and made them unavailable. That's a big part of the story there. But it is, of course, possible to give single-dose vaccines. It's just it would just be more of them.
Okay, and in Wakefield's situation, you included him in vaccine epidemic. He has been discredited. Hugely. He's been accused of fraud by a leading medical journal. There's an investigative reporter who has done a multi-part investigation in the Sunday Times out there about him. And, you know, this reporter, we just talked to him earlier, swears by his work and his research. I don't think he's got an axe to grind, does he, the reporter?
Oh, I think that bears scrutiny, George. Brian Deer has been making a cottage industry of his accusations against against Andrew Wakefield since 2004. So, you know, we're going on 7 years.
But is he right?
Well, there's a lot of allegations that he has been paid by the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of allegations that it was his stories that are the basis for the prosecution, the regulatory prosecution against Dr. Wakefield and his two colleagues. I've looked at the data through 2010. So there's a lot of new allegations that came out in January. I conclude in the book that there's, I don't see any basis for the allegations that were made through 2010. His new allegations, which were published in the British Medical Journal early this year in three different segments, I'm not quite clear why he's bringing these. I'm not quite clear what they add to this. I'd be interested to hear what he has to say. I think a lot of what he's doing makes no sense at all. In the British Medical Journal, he's saying that the records that were held by Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital don't tally up exactly with the records of the general medical practitioners who were treating the children, who were the basis for this Lancet study in 1998. Well, they wouldn't be. I mean, different doctors are going to write down different things in their medical notes. I really question, who is Brian Deere? What does he stand for? What is his stake in this? Why is he doing that? Those are not the questions, George, that the mainstream media, when they gave so much attention to Brian Deere's allegations earlier in January, those are not the questions that mainstream media was asking.
I mean, he alleges that, Wakefield, with a business with his wife's name, wanted his own replacement vaccines, wanted to sell diagnostic testing kits, and talked about making $43 million doing it. So who knows?
Well, I am looking forward to the dialogue that I hope will happen between Brian Deere and Andy Wakefield.
Well, they're going to be on separately because they'll end up screaming at each other.
I agree with that. But I think it's a useful thing to hear counterpoint on this, because I do think that, in my view, the real importance of Dr. Wakefield is that he has stood for, we need to get answers on these questions. We need to find out what is the real story on vaccine safety. We need to further investigate, are vaccines associated with autism? We don't have the answers. And Dr. Wakefield, in my view, has stood for the premise, we have to investigate and we have to get answers. And he has stood by, we have to treat these children who have severe bowel syndromes and autism. And that association exists, George, and no discrediting of Dr. Wakefield's 1998 case series report is going to undermine that. There is a syndrome of severe bowel symptoms and autism, and nothing that Brian Deere says really undoes that. And it's as if he's trying to say that, to discredit that this set of symptoms exists. And I don't understand that. I really don't understand that.
Well, unfortunately, I think Wakefield's test was only, 12 children? That should be bigger.
It's a case series. Well, of course, it's a case series, George. It was not a controlled study. It was merely, he was saying, he had been an expert in the measles up until that point. He had published several papers about it, in his view, association between the measles virus and gut disease. And so parents started to go to him and say, look, we think that there's a connection between our kids' autism and their gut symptoms and having gotten the MMR. And so Dr. Wakefield started to investigate that. I believe the evidence shows strongly that he was investigating that. He was working with his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital in London, and he had already submitted the article to The Lancet, which is where it was published, before he started a study for this lawsuit, which he was certainly an expert in and was involved in. In my chapter about this brouhaha in the book, I point out that, in my view, the two studies, the Lancet study and the litigation study, have been conflated. They've been combined.
All right, stay with us, Mary. We're at the top of the hour, but we shall be right back on Coast to Coast AM.